From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. There's rising opposition to the still unreleased Obama administration's rating system for colleges and universities. A new report suggests efforts to game the U.S. News college rankings can be both expensive and ineffective. And an American Council on Education briefing for campus officials about a U.S. Senate survey on sexual violence emphasizes PR and political risks rather than institutional responsibilities to potential victims. Hi, this is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Our panelists for the conversation this week are Ralph Kunzel, who's the president of the University of Redlands, a physician by training. Ralph previously served as a vice provost at Johns Hopkins and provost at Bryn Mawr College and the University of Rochester before his current presidency at Redlands. Zakiya Smith, strategy director at the Lumina Foundation, was formerly a senior education advisor at the White House Domestic Policy Council. And Doug Letterman is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your comments on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. Ralph, before we begin the panel conversation today, we want to acknowledge the campus shooting on Thursday afternoon at Seattle Pacific University. Early reports indicate that the gunman had no direct link to the university, but following the recent and tragic shootings in Santa Barbara and the conversation about sexual violence launched by the Obama administration in May, do yesterday's events elevate the pressures or expectations that college presidents will or should step up in their public comments about violence and that campuses will have to step in terms of mental health issues and services for students? Ralph?
Well, Casey, thanks for not avoiding the obvious sadness of the week. As far as mental health services, we already provide an enormous array of medical and counseling for today's students. It's really not your father's student health center anymore. But yes, this is such a sad event, and my heart goes out to the family-like communities and the presidents at UC Santa Barbara and Seattle Pacific. Speaking as a college president, I think we must talk about gun control and how campuses are perhaps uniquely affected. We as presidents are not aligned with many other groups, however. College presidents are already universally opposed, nearly so, to possessing guns on campus. But many of our millennial students are now actually in favor of more guns on campus, both arming campus safety officers and, in some states, even concealed carrying of guns on campus. I'm waiting to hear from our faculty, whose long-term experience may be more determinant. But we must speak out, and so I, myself, speak out right now. There should be no lethal weapons on our campuses. I'm afraid that the old metaphor for mass murder was going postal, and I fear the new one might become going collegiate.
Ralph, but let's talk candidly about the influence of college presidents speaking out. Symbolically, certainly it's important. Substantively, does it make a difference to audiences beyond the campus?
Well, in the days of Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, it certainly did. College presidents were frequently public spokespersons. That was the day of the bully pulpit. I think most presidents now acknowledge that their political impact has been diminished. They certainly have occasionally a bully pulpit, but mostly they carry a bag of political capital which must be spent very carefully and slowly. And so I think that's why you see a little bit less commentary these days. But this is one issue, gun control, that I certainly could get behind as a relatively apolitical person. And I think this is perhaps the right time to do it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ralph, very much. Let's turn to the story about opposition to the federal ratings as proposed by the Obama administration. Although there remains great ambiguity and uncertainty about just how the federal government plans to rank and rate colleges and universities as part of the ratings initiative announced last fall, opposition among college and university leaders to the concept of an actual plan, which is expected in fall 2014, is wide and increasingly deep. Yet even as education leaders on campus and in Washington might agree on the need for accountability, hard to be opposed to accountability, which clearly is the goal of the administration's ranking proposals, various constituencies are beginning to articulate opposition to different components of the accountability metrics that might be part of the plan when it is announced in the coming months. Doug, there is this ambiguity about what the administration would like to do, plans to do, how it plans to do it. Clearly, it's not going to do a U.S. News and World Report type rankings, but give us some language and some context for a common background to go forward with this conversation.
Sure. Thanks, Casey. And thanks to Zakiya and Ralph for being here. So the president, as you said, announced this last fall, and this is said to be an intensely personal priority for President Obama based on his own and his wife's college and law school debt. By leaving you pointed out that they have left the ratings idea, announced it in sort of broad terms, having left it pretty undefined all these months, they've allowed people to come out of the woodwork defining it for themselves and not liking what they're imagining. So you were right that there is generalized opposition from higher ed leaders and lots of legitimate questions being raised about things such as the quality of the data and whether the mechanism will differentiate sufficiently among types of institutions and the kinds of students they serve. But while they're united in opposition to what the administration has proposed or what they think the administration is planning to do, Michael Stratford's story on our site this week shows that there are also real chasms among higher ed sectors, different parts of higher education, about the extent and limits of the federal role in holding higher ed accountable. And there are a couple of key dividing lines. One is over whether it is appropriate for the feds to come up with a new way of allocating federal student financial aid that would tie eligibility or the size of student grants to how institutions are performing on a range of measures. One of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, while sort of distancing itself from the Obama plan, has come forward with an alternative proposal to tie colleges' receipt of aid to a set of metrics that are related to graduates' loan repayment and the rates of employment and entry into grad school for graduates. And that puts it at odds with private institutions, which very much oppose a link in general to student aid. They argue that the existing ways of holding institutions accountable through the Education Department's current methods and state oversight and accreditation are still up to the job. The other major divide is over student data. Administration officials say they're planning to use the current data to build the rating system. There's a fairly widespread view that it will be difficult, if not impossible, to do this right without what in Washington jargon is called a unit record system, a database that would track students at the individual level as they move into, through, and out of higher education. Only with such a system, advocates for the unit records argue, can all the movement of students between institutions and students enrolling in multiple colleges at the same time be captured in ways that give a true picture of how institutions are faring. Most of the public college groups, community colleges, and four-year publics support it. But it's generally opposed by leaders of independent institutions who raise sort of big brother privacy concerns and with some other recent missteps by the administration, like with healthcare, they also question how well-suited the government is to manage and maintain such a system. So right now we're seeing the administration seems intent on moving forward, although there's some noise in Congress about blocking it, but we're almost certain to see, the rating system aside, more accountability metrics imposed as Congress considers the Higher Education Act in the next couple of years.
So, Zakiya, accountability is one of those issues where everybody's in favor of it as long as you do it on my terms and not yours. And I think the other thing that clearly we hear in Doug's comments is this decades-long argument on behalf of the higher education community at large that says, trust us. We have mechanisms, accrediting some other mechanisms to kind of do what you're doing. A lot of the data that presumably would be used or feed any kind of rating system the administration might use is in many ways already out there in terms of retention rates, loan repayment rates, other kinds of things. What's missing in sort of the broader understanding for the rest of us in terms of understanding why this initiative and why now?
Well, I think I would quibble a little bit with everyone agreeing about accountability. One of the interesting things with this proposal is that rather than using the ambiguity as an opportunity to say what the rating should be or what metrics should be used or how they would like to be held accountable, there's just been, at first, there was just a broad, massive cry not to do anything at all. And that's kind of been the theme of the higher education leadership, broadly speaking, over the years, regardless of what administration. And so while this proposal has been very controversial in the way that it's been rolled out and the way it's been talked about as ratings versus rankings and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, the concept of having some accountability for the large amount of federal student aid has been something that's administration after administration, Republicans and Democrats alike, have been in favor of, and repeatedly the higher education establishment has kind of come out against most of the proposals. So I think it's really an opportunity right now to define what kinds of things people would like to be held accountable for, because it seems like nothing.
Ralph, as a college president, what are you willing to be held accountable for in the context of what the administration might do?
Well, I certainly don't have the kind of knee-jerk opposition to it that I think NICU has expressed. I don't have
privacy concerns. And NICU, we should add, is the Association of Independent Colleges.
Yeah, and many privates, private institutions have met privately with the leaders of the Department of Education and expressed their concerns. I have too. And our concerns really are on unintended consequences, not on the concept of accountability. Take the three metrics that are being most commonly discussed: retention and graduation, first; second, the employment experience and income; and third, the ability of students to repay loans. So they first, at first glance, they seem innocuous, but they have to be tied to inputs. For example, graduation rates. What type of students are in that college or in that sector? Because certainly socioeconomic status and age and abilities that they come to college with are predictive of graduation rates. So you really don't want to penalize certain diverse and high-access institutions. People who are working, people who are married or older or less prepared are less likely to graduate. So the idea is just don't be bland and general in applying these kinds of metrics, but worry always about unintended consequences. Even employment experience. The problem there is that we've translated value of education to income or rates of employment, as opposed to whether graduates can read or think critically, or whether they vote. And we've forgotten the Jeffersonian principles about what's important about education and translated that to dollars of income. So each one of these factors just have to be considered far more carefully than they have been so far.
Zakiya, the administration states that the goal of this rating system is both to serve students as consumers and also provide a broader context for the conversation about accountability. Is it possible to do both with one mechanism?
I think it's actually very difficult to serve both needs with the same display and the same actual information. The thing that we know from all types of consumer information tools in various different industries and service sector industries and experience goods is that they have to be clear and that people have to understand how you came at the kind of rating. How did you give, what are your criteria for an A or a B or a C or what have you? It needs to be something that is very simple, 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 diamonds, whatever. Whereas something that's used for accountability, everyone kind of thinks that you need to have these nuances that were just mentioned. You need to be able to kind of differentiate between different types of colleges, which I would add the administration has always said that they would do. They've never said that they would broadly apply the same standards across. From the minute the president, mentioned this, the first thing that was said was that they would compare similar types of institutions. And I think it would be interesting to get into a conversation of, again, what should those measures be? We know what the problems could potentially be. We know what the downsides could be, what the potential unintended consequences are. But without providing an actual alternative of how you could potentially provide good information to students and or good information to feed into an accountability, it's almost the same thing as opposing it outright because you're providing no alternative. So I think that those two things are different, what students need and what you would need from an accountability standpoint, but the same data sets could be used to achieve those goals.
Well, Doug, let me turn to you. You know, in one sense, along to follow up on Zakiya's comment, if it's a 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, the reality is that the vast majority of students ages 16 to 66 who enroll in post-secondary institutions, public, independent, nonprofit, and private for-profit, are largely captive. They go to places near where they live. They don't, you know, while we talk about student choice and we hear stories of undergraduates applying to 5, 10, and 20 institutions, that's really a small segment of colleges and a small segment of the student population. Most students, you know, we look at the enrollments in community college. Those are largely local and captive students, also metropolitan state schools. If the local institutions where I live are 1- and 2-star institutions, what difference does that make in terms of my options?
Well, I think Zakiya put her finger on the really important issue. This, I don't think the one system can do both of these things. And I think our general sense is that the student information part of this is unlikely to have much effect. Going back to when Margaret Spellings, and again, Zakiya is right, this crosses administrations. Back when Margaret Spellings was talking, she was the education secretary under President Bush, when she was talking about the same basic set of issues, a lot of this information is already out there, and students don't use it. Now, it can be made more presented better, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the really important conversation going forward is about accountability and how institutions, I think we're past the days when higher education leaders could just say, just trust us, we're doing well, and also could say, these things are hard to measure, so we can't. We're in an era of evidence, and I think higher ed is in a position of needing to prove its excellence and value. And it's tricky, though, because our public policy doesn't do sophisticated and complicated really well. And per Ralph's point, this is a hard set of things to measure. But again, we're at the point where they just have to figure out a way. And I think higher ed enterprise has sort of brought this on itself a little bit by not putting forward a set of measures and metrics on which it is willing to be measured. And we're starting to see that. And I think a lot of what's happening here is that the administration is doing this to try to a little bit of a 2x4 across the head to try to prompt college leaders to come forward themselves and say, these are the ways in which we are willing to be judged. And I think that's going to be useful ultimately.
Ralph, let me turn to you on this in terms of Doug's comment about evidence. In 1980, the Southern Association of Colleges was the first of the 6 regional accrediting associations to talk about outcomes as part of the accrediting process as opposed to some harder quantitative criteria. We have lived for decades now with what we might characterize as mandates without methodologies, and in fact, huge numbers of provosts who participated in, a 2012 Inside Higher Ed survey of chief academic officers agreed that the associations have put forward the mandate on outcomes without providing any clear methodologies to do so. Does the administration's initiative do anything in terms of clarifying the conversation about agreement on metrics that get towards this end?
I think we all agree on the variables. Access is important, affordability is important, and outcomes are important. The phrase that resonates with me is the mandate without methodology. Now, look, bottom line is that federal agencies don't have a great track record of advanced data systems. If any rating system were implemented today, it would probably take 10 years before the data systems would catch up with the ability to actually do it. And that's because the rating system proposals that tie ratings to the amount of aid an institution would receive could cause colleges and universities to game the system by warping their admissions to control the outcomes in their favor. They might seek, for example, to enroll more full-time, full-pay students or business majors to merely improve their ratings. But the most serious fallacy of the financial aid rating system is that it uses post-graduation income as one of the outcome measures, and that indicate value. It's a synonymization of value with income. Do we really want to create more Wall Street brokers and fewer school teachers? I think not. And the idea that it's okay to treat every sector alike within its sector is also short-sighted, because not all liberal arts colleges are the same. For example, Amherst has a very high percentage of Pell Grant students, and other colleges don't, and that would certainly affect the ratings in the long run.
All right. You know what? We could go on with this and other, for a long time. We're going to shift a little bit, and Ralph, in fact, you gave us the entree to do that when you talked about gaming the system, because you're the co-author on a new report that talks about efforts to game the U.S. news ratings, and your report suggests that efforts to do so would be both incredibly expensive and also clearly ineffective. Quickly, if you would, sort of summarize some of the key findings from that for us, if you would.
Well, it seems to me that presidents, trustees, and alumni and students have been exceedingly interested, you know, maybe that's just the American way, exceedingly interested in rankings and lists. And it turns out that students and parents aren't so responsive to rankings in their choice of college. They're much more responsive to whether there's a Division I basketball team or whether there's a scandal on a campus. But trustees and presidents, I think, who might well, no better, have been really taken by these rankings, and some of them have even posed strategic plans that are focused on the goal of raising their rankings into, say, the top 20. And alumni are especially interested in these as well, and so it seemed to me rather important to find out what the actual facts are behind variability in ratings.
You know, I recall being in airports in small towns when the U.S. news would hit the newsstand, and the local college would pay for a post-it note on the cover that would say, you know, Acme College identified as the best college in these six counties, kinds of things, as an extension of the kind of jockeying that you're talking about among institutions that may not have any resonance with students. Doug, you've watched this rankings phenomenon for a long time, and clearly, would you agree, rather, that at least as Ralph suggested, maybe institutional leadership as opposed to consumers who become captive to this?
Well, yes, and the one thing to keep in mind is that while this directly affects a relatively small number of institutions, there are only, I don't know what percentage of all institutions that are in one way or another ranked by U.S. News, but it's a pretty small fraction, probably not even 10%. And I mean, Ralph's paper with his co-authors really makes a pretty powerful set of arguments that it's very difficult to move an institution significantly, so that a lot of effort focused on this by institutions is a waste of time. But it does, the rankings do matter in to institutions beyond the ones that are ranked, because the changes, when institutions pursue the changes, and in general, U.S. News rewards wealth, it rewards selectivity, it rewards a lot of things that don't necessarily fulfill public purposes. And when institutions that are trying to move in the rankings pursue those goals, their competitors, who might be a notch or two down and maybe not even ranked, have to respond in the competition for students. So even if students aren't paying too much attention to U.S. News rankings themselves, if institutions start becoming more selective or start spending money on things that help them move in the rankings rather than on things that necessarily help students. And true, some of the things in the U.S. News rankings, as U.S. News has tried to respond, do pay attention to student retention and other things that are student-focused, but a lot of the things aren't. But that affects everybody, and it affects many institutions, not just the ones that are sort of directly chasing the rankings.
Zakiya, Ralph's paper suggests it is ineffective but expensive to game the U.S. news rankings, but at the same time, you know, in the context of the conversation we just completed about the administration's proposals, would we not expect institutions to game that as well once this plan is out?
Well, I think about the the analogy to teaching to the test, and I've always heard that if the test is good, that you don't mind if people teach to it. So if the ratings were actually something that was more about our public purposes of higher education, if it was actually more about being rewarded for enrolling more students that need remediation or more students that are Pell recipients or completing more students that are Pell recipients, as the administration has said that that's what the goal is to reward institutions for better behavior, and then perhaps you could see a movement away from the types of things that are rewarded in, you know, U.S. News and World Report that people seem not to like, and toward these other things. And so I think it's quite interesting that people dislike the effect that U.S. News has had on colleges and universities' behavior. And then when someone says that they would like to create something that provides different incentives that are more egalitarian, that those things are not kind of lauded, that the idea is that we should just have no types of ratings. And I think that's what people would maybe prefer, but I don't know if that's, I know it's not realistic, and I think that we should just consider what types of information would be appropriate rather than immediately assuming, appropriate to drive people to good behavior. I guess that's the thing. How do we drive people to behavior that we would like to see?
Ralph, it seems to me that in one sense, the U.S. news rankings are dependent upon, the consent of the complainants. Everybody hates them, and yet nobody, the efforts on the part of some campuses to say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to play in this sandbox anymore by providing data have not been effective. Is it time for the complainants to just say no more?
Well, you know, I you're exactly right. We put ourselves in an uncomfortable place. The most famous complainant to just say enough, no more, was Reed College, and they sort of got punished as a result of that over the years. And people just don't want to go there. But my advice to campuses is don't put your rankings on your webpage, and don't be overly proud about something that really can't be changed much. And the major point of the paper we wrote, which was based on a computer simulation, is that some things are unchangeable. They're immutable. And the reputation score, which is the greatest weight in U.S. News ranking, simply can't be moved. The chance of making a movement of even one rank or anything that is significant is less than 0.01%. And so you shouldn't spend money on what is immovable. An example is that in my mailbox every month I get about a foot-tall stack of glossy brochures hoping that I will change my opinion of a college or university. And that's silly, because presidents and provosts are often just using knowledge or experience that's 20 years old or secondhand, and they just start from where the previous rank was. And that's why the reputational scores is the least valuable part of rankings. My advice to everyone is, let's just focus on the fundamentals instead.
All right, focus. I'm going to have to move on. I'm sorry, we're very much watching the time. And again, this is one where we could go on for a number of minutes. I want to move us to something about the immovable that moved this past week. Following the May launch of the Obama administration's initiative on sexual violence on campus, Senator Claire McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri and chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Financial Contracting and Oversight, announced plans for a national, quote, survey of campus sexual violence policies and procedures. In response to the survey initiative, the American Council on Education, also known as ACE, prepared a PowerPoint briefing about the Senate survey intended only for campus personnel. Senator McCaskill asked for a copy of the briefing materials, and ACE politely declined. But yesterday, after rebuffing the senator's recurring requests for the briefing documents, ACE released the materials, which emphasized the PR and political risks of the survey as opposed to the campus responsibilities to protect students who've been subject to sexual violence. Let me add, for the record, it looks as if Inside Higher Ed was the first news organization to gain access to the slides ahead of the public release. Zakiya, you've worked in the White House. You know, as somebody watching this from the distance, what's your take about this back and forth between the senator and ACE and the folks at DuPont Circle?
Well, let me just first say that I'm really glad that Senator McCaskill has decided to take on this issue. This kind of what's going on campuses with sexual violence is really important. But from the kind of political angle, I always think that anything that you provide via email or out to a mass of people that's not a conversation that you're sure isn't being recorded on the phone is likely to get out to people, no matter if you say it's off the record or whatever, it's likely to get out. So I try to, I think people should just remember that that's always going to happen. And so any people have a way of getting access to documents, and once something's been transmitted over email or, you know, on the computer or something like that to a in a briefing type of way, it's hard to assume that it won't be shared anyway. So I'm not sure if there was kind of some kind of, like, you know, client. I understand the survey, the PowerPoint was done by their legal counsel, so maybe they thought there was attorney-client privilege or something like that. But once you send something out like that, it's going to get out, and so you should just be comfortable in knowing that. And I think this is probably an issue that got ahead of folks, and the general response of a group like ACE is to protect its members. That's what people pay for. So it's kind of expected that that would be the content, I think, although it's kind of unfortunate that there's not a greater sensitivity to the needs of victims, and that's what people are a little recoiling to over time.
Ralph, as a college president, was the ACE initiative, the briefing, was that an appropriate or an overreach? And, you know, by extension, was the initial refusal to release those materials, again, appropriate or an overreach?
Well, the refusal to release, it was a mistake. It does not inspire confidence in ACA leadership. And that's because, you know, all of us expect surveys, rankings, ratings to be fair and balanced, valid, reliable, bias-free, but we can't have it both ways. This applies to webinars as well. But to be fair, this appears to have been outsourced. So just consider the source, a hired group of attorneys who are steeped in risk management and over-focused on risk. Well, the outcome is not very surprising, but let's be fair about it. The webinar slide set is just a slice in time. It's not the full context of fairness that ACE is known to espouse. It does not indicate ACE's strong tolerance and diversity and their intolerance of sexual assault or their proactive stance on women and diversity and all that ACE stands for. So I think in the end, reasonable people will realize it was only one webinar, one audience, one context, but a PR mistake, nevertheless.
PR mistake, nonetheless. Doug, are there consequences for ACE or ACE's leadership, or is this, as Ralph suggests, something that will pass with time?
Oh, it's. I think it's a little bit of a. It'll be a temporary setback. I mean, it was not smart. It was a little tone deaf. I mean, I think Ralph's absolutely right that this is kind of what you'd expect from a lawyer, from a group of lawyers, given their focus. But because it looks like the sort of mean statement that ACE was making to its members about what Senator McCaskill was trying to do, it didn't. The PowerPoint didn't say, and obviously these were just slides presented in a webinar, so we have to take that into account as well. And just for what it's worth, per Zakiya's point, our reporter FOIA'd the submitted an open records request in Florida. It was a very smart thing because Florida has the broadest open records laws, and our reporter used a lot of ingenuity to go do that. But it is. I think we can't read too much into it, but it does feed the impression that lots of people I've talked to on the Hill over the years and in the administration have said that this perception that the higher ed lobby sort of is just constantly playing defense and. But that's part of its job, no question. But in this particular case, it really looks tone deaf because it didn't express any desire, any concern about the whole set of issues related to sexual assault on campus. And again, it is a Ralph's right, it's a point in time, but it just looked bad. And I don't think there's going to be long-term impact. I think it frankly just feeds the sort of the meme that people tend to think about the higher ed lobby to begin with.
All right, great. Good conversation today. Panel, you each get one last comment. What have we missed in our conversation about the past week's events? Or what should we be attending to in the coming weeks? Very quickly, about 10, 15 seconds each. Zakiya, let me begin with you.
Sure. I think the fact that many states are backing out of the Common Core, not many, but several states are backing out of the Common Core should be alarming to those in higher education who've kind of been concerned about remediation and the preparedness of students coming from high school, given what the promise of the Common Core was. And looking ahead to next week, the president and some senators are supposed to be announcing new actions on student loans, so that'll be very interesting.
Ralph, Closing comment?
I'll focus on the word interaction. It will be interesting for me to see the interaction of federal ratings and U.S. News rankings, two of today's topics, because truly robust federal ratings may require unit record student data, and that would likely change any rankings data because of the substantive effect of unit record on graduation rates.
Great. And Doug, closing comment.
I actually just want to close where we started, expressing our condolences and concern to the people at Seattle Pacific and by extension those at UCSB. Let's hope we're not repeating this conversation in a week or two or ever. So that's all.
Great. Thank you. And my thanks to the three of you, Zakiya Smith, Ralph Kunzel, and Doug Letterman, for being with us today. And our thanks to you, the audience, for joining us for this edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This Week is available as an audio stream or podcast beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your comments about This Week with us on the comments section. Please share This Week with your colleagues. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.